inspiring interviews with today's top landlords. This is the Rental Income Podcast. And now, Dan Lane.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that there's lots of different strategies to invest in rentals, and most of them work very well. But one strategy that is guaranteed to eventually fail you is investing for appreciation. It's very, very dangerous. And my guest on the podcast today learned that the hard way. She started investing for appreciation, not really caring about cash flow, and it was working out great until the market shifted, and then she ended up losing a lot of rentals. She had a short sale, a bunch of her properties. But she learned from it, and today she only invests for cash flow, and her portfolio is doing great. So I think this is going to be a really inspiring story. So let's take a real quick break. We'll get a word in from our sponsors. We'll come right back, and we'll talk to Jaylee Ridge. The first step in buying a rental property is to get pre-qualified, and I would suggest you work with a lender that specializes in working with investors, because the last thing you want to have happen is to get to closing and find out the money's not there and you can't close. The lender that I recommend is Jaylee Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. She's a nationwide lender and she'll pre-qualify you for free if you mention Rental Income Podcast. Find out more today. Contact Jaylee at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E. lendinggroup.com. NMLS 42056. Are you looking for actionable steps to create wealth and passive income? As a top-ranked business and investing podcast with over 800 five-star reviews, the Passive Real Estate Investing Show is packed with strategies and insight for putting money in your pocket. Marco Santarelli from Narada Real Estate Investments brings his expertise and knowledge on both passive and turnkey real estate investing, and he provides listeners with helpful tools and tips to create the wealth you've always wanted. Head over to iTunes or Google Play today and subscribe to Passive Real Estate Investing Podcast, or visit PassiveRealEstateInvesting.com. That's PassiveRealEstateInvesting.com. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to point out to everybody that Jaylee's company, Ridge Lending Group, is a sponsor of the podcast, but Jaylee is not paying to be here today. She's a guest, just like anybody else. We don't do sponsored content on the show, so Jaylee's here to tell her story, and let's just get right into it. So Jaylee, tell us, how did you first get started in real estate?
First property that I bought was in Florida with my father. This was over 20 years ago. So we got into, I was a pre-med student, actually. I'll try to be brief on this. I don't want to bore anybody with my with my rhetoric. But I was a pre-med student, and I went back to school later in life. And I'd always been self-employed prior to that. I had a few of my own businesses. And I learned pretty quickly that being a starving student just was not for me. My father was in the lending industry, and then we started investing ourselves. We started seeing these opportunities, and together, like I said, I had 42 properties at the height. He had double what I had, it just kept rolling. Now, the real estate cycle, investment cycle, equally as different from what it is today.
Right. So back then, when people were buying investment properties, were they not really focused on cash flow as much as people seem to be today? Was it more, I'm going to buy this property because I know it's going to appreciate?
Absolutely correct. In fact, so of the 42 properties that I held, my clients, when I'm talking to them throughout the week, they're always surprised to hear not one of those properties cash flow, not one.
Wow.
So that cycle was exclusively about appreciation. Now, you know, in terms of the cash flow or the lack thereof of cash flow on those properties, it varied from property to property, you know, $50 negative here, $100 there, maybe more, right? But yeah, it was all about appreciation and maybe even considered a little out of control in certain markets.
Yeah.
And the lending guidelines and availability to that money and that leverage was so free and available. We were refinancing on a consistent basis, right? So we started by purchasing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Those would appreciate. We do a cash out refinances. Borrowed funds are non-taxable. We'd take those monies and purchase another property and so on and so forth. So we were able to really utilize what the benefits of that particular market were at the time. So yes, in answer to your question, not one of them was positive, and it was a negative month by month by month, but we were able to use the leverage and cash out to cover those and purchase more.
You know, it's crazy because looking at this through the lens of today, that sounds like so risky. Like if I was talking to an investor today and they were telling me this was their plan, my initial thought is, oh my God, this is not going to end well. But back then, like it was working out. So looking back on it, like, do you think that was a bad decision to buy properties that weren't positive cash flow every month? Or do you think that it was just a different world back then?
Well, I think that your instincts would have been right. And I think that the general answer would be yes, that was a bad idea. But with the precipice or the added response to say, the lessons that I learned are about diversification and balance. I think appreciation, you know, I find that in my conversations with my clients and colleagues and things, because of what we saw with real estate, you know, in prior to the 08-09 implosion, people now reject appreciation as a means of benefit for real estate, right? I mean, they just, they won't even look at it. And I think that that's a little bit short-sighted. We, you know, if I can just take a second and sort of give some comparisons from that cycle to this cycle, obviously we've already identified all appreciation, no cash flow. Price points were significantly higher. Interest rates were significantly higher than they are now. Leverage significantly higher, right? People didn't really have a lot of skin in the game. Right. I did 5 and 10% down loans, making it, you know, even more leverage opportunity, but less cash flow versus now we've got much lower price points, average, national average. Interest rates are still at an all-time low. You're putting 20, 25% down, so you've got that extra skin in the game. And the market has shifted. You've got rents that are more than covering for the new mortgage payments for all those reasons and actually several more. So to define it in a way, was it bad? Was it good? We did very well, very, very well in that marketplace until we didn't, right? And so you're right in that if I could go back and know what I know now, I would do things very differently in that I would have balanced it better. I would have definitely found properties that had the cash flow to help balance some of the other, you know, I wouldn't have been all in one bundle and focusing exclusively on one piece of real estate benefit. We've got cash flow, we've got appreciation, we've got tax benefit. And really, at the time, it was only about the tax benefit and appreciation. So, did I answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I 100% agree with you about people discounting appreciation. And I think maybe it's because of the point in the market where we are, where it's like you can't control appreciation. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. But that is like such a strong wealth building part of real estate that, you know, you probably are going to have appreciation on a lot of real estate in the future. So I think that investors should factor that into their analysis on a property.
As long as it cash flows, right? And that's key. It has to cash flow.
Yeah.
The appreciating states, and here's, you already know this, I'm sure, but for some of your listeners that may not be aware, they'll find that when they're out there looking at some of that diversification, the higher the market is for cash flow, generally speaking, the lower the appreciation and vice versa.
Right.
The higher the appreciation, the lower the cash flow. But so long as you still have cash flow, even if it's a little bit less than some of the other markets without appreciation, I think that a healthy balance of that, maybe an 80-20, 70-30 split is appropriate, right? The primary focus is high cash flow. But don't discount that appreciation or just totally reject it. I think that there's some real long-term benefit to it.
Right. Okay, so you're buying properties. You've got this system figured out where the properties are appreciating a little bit. You're taking out that equity. You're buying more properties. Were you in different markets? Like, were you buying all over the country, or were you focused in on just one or two areas?
Good question. And that's where I think I did get it right. We were diversified all over the U.S., not putting all of our eggs in one basket. That would have been even more devastating. to the what we went through in the collapse. So yeah, all over the U.S., we found that the Sun Belt states is what they're referred to, the Carolinas, Florida, Texas, Georgia, you know, the along the coastal range. Those are the markets that generally performed at the highest in appreciation.
Was it hard?
We were in land too.
Like to me, it just seems so foreign to buy properties in all kinds of different areas. Did it just become normal that the more you did it, the more it just seemed normal to buy properties in multiple markets?
And sight unseen and all that stuff. Yeah. You know, at first I was a little bit leery of the whole idea of turnkey and sight unseen. But remember, we kind of established ourselves as this lender that was the expert in the turnkey non-owner occupied space. So it boded well for our clients that we were actually invested in some of these markets, that we were working with the different turnkeys. 9.9 times out of 10, it worked out just fine because, you know, most of the national turnkeys were vetting very carefully the local area wholesalers, right?
Okay.
So did we have some bad experiences? Sure. It's a cost of investing, but otherwise, it was a pretty good experience.
Okay.
Most of the players out there at the time knew what they were doing, gave good product, et cetera. Yeah.
Okay. So you built the portfolio. You're buying more and more properties. What happened when things changed? At some point, the market changed. Like, were you not able to keep things going, or was it the market with the prices going down? Like, how did things end?
Yeah. So our story is going to be a little bit unique. And without putting too fine a point on it, it was a friggin' bloodbath, man. It was intense, and it was a light switch, literally.
Wow.
So we go to having unlimited availability of access to capital, right? Just an overwhelming, diverse menu of products that were available and out there. And then because the housing market and the lending market simultaneously both imploded, we found ourselves with all these properties, right? A lot of them were on ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages.
Right.
Some even on a 6-month ARM in markets, let's say Florida, for example, where it was new construction. We knew we'd be able to sell it and turn around and make our profit in some of those cases. But these mortgages, 6-month ARM, for example, started to adjust. The lending opportunities went from unlimited to literally nothing overnight. So as an example, let's talk about conventional financing. The number of allowable financed properties per a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac was unlimited as long as you qualified. It went from that within, I'm not kidding you, a matter of weeks to 4 max.
Wow.
And remember too, that our livelihood was tied to the income that we were making was related to the financing we were able to get for our investors. So there's that piece. The price points and the values went from X to Z again within, 6 months' time, where you had a property that was probably a value of $500,000 and maybe we owed, $300,000. Now the value is probably $150,000, $160,000. That's a good example.
Yeah.
So because both of those things happened at the same time, we found ourselves in a place where, one, we couldn't get into the cap any of the equity that we had. Then the equity went away. We had no option to refinance out of any existing loans that we had and recast a new interest rate. The rates just kept going up because of what was happening. So, we got hit from all directions, and it was devastating.
Oh,
of the 42 that we had, I'm left with 11.
Wow.
11 left out of all of those.
Wow.
We did short sales, quite a few short sales. Deed in lieu of foreclosure was a part of what we had to work with. It was rough, a very, very profound learning experience.
Oh, I bet. So of the 11 properties that were left, like what was different with those properties than the ones that you lost?
Well, the short sales were not, that was an interesting time for short sales. Anybody that was around in that time knows what I speak of when I refer to short sales. It was just mind numbing, the brain damage that you had to go through to get one of those done. I think that in those cases, though, the values were low enough that they weren't going to take them back. They weren't going to accept the short sale. We worked on modifications, right? Mm-hmm. Mortgage modifications, and were able to retain the properties and just kind of hold on long enough so that the values came back up. Cash flows were better because of some of the modification work. I'm happy to say that of all of those properties, they are cash flowing nicely now, 10 years later. So, yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Now, the properties, the 11 properties you have left, are they diversified in different areas today? Or
yeah.
Okay. So you're in several different markets, several different types of properties too?
Let's see. Of the 11 left, I think that three of them are 2 to 4 unit. The rest of them are single family. And
okay.
we really, even back then, we focused mostly on single family. We did have, you know, 2 to 4. I didn't get into commercial.
Okay.
That wasn't part of our wheelhouse or our strategy.
Man, you know, what a crazy story. I mean, it's like everything was going great. And it just ended so quickly. And then with your day job being doing loans, I guess it was probably hard to make loans at that point, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, we went from very, very good income to, and I say light switch. I'm not kidding, Dan. It was immediate and
wow.
and swift and. We thought, you know, all the while, and we had the funds to go ahead and keep these negatives going for some time, a few years actually, thinking there's no way this can continue. It's going
right.
to rebound. We're going to get out of this. We're going to have options. And, you know, the longer we waited, the longer we saw that wasn't going to be the case. We a lot of money we put back into the properties to float them while we were kind of having this hope that we'd have more opportunity to refinance and get some fixed terms, et cetera. I don't think that was your question. I failed to answer the question.
Well, let me ask you this. So what do you think that investors can do today for if the rules change again in the future? That, the, you know, it's like the rules, the way you made money in real estate back then basically changed overnight. Like,
right.
do you think that could ever happen again? Or do you
no.
think because things are so focused on cash flow today that investors are safer?
No, we'll never see another repeat of what 08, 09 presented. And anybody, you know, I get to talk to a lot of different experts and people, economists and things. Anybody that has over the years has told me that they knew that both of those things were going to happen at the same time, that the housing market would just plummet through the floor and that the lending market would just explode on itself, that both of those things were going to happen simultaneously.
Yeah.
No way. They did not know that. I don't believe that for a second. And I think that that's why we found it so devastating to the U.S. economy and markets here. Do I think that that's even possible in our lifetime? No, I do not.
Right.
I think that from the old cycle to the new cycle, if I could start all over again and be a brand new investor in this particular real estate cycle where cash flow is king, I'd be very happy to be
right, sure.
to be in that place and starting fresh. But
yeah.
But for a variety of reasons that I've already mentioned, skin in the game, you've got 20-25% down, interest rates are much lower, price points are much lower. If a property, a $100,000 property, goes unrented, right, for a month or 2 months, a $500 PITI, principal, interest, tax, and insurance mortgage payment is going to be a heck of a lot easier to cover for an individual than a $250,000 mortgage,
right.
which was the average back then. So
yeah.
for those reasons that I think I'm regurgitating a little bit and several more, I do not see it as a possibility that investors today are in. The risk involved with real estate investing today versus then it's not even comparable.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I'm really happy that you came on and shared your story. It's scary just to think that could happen, but I do agree with you that I think that was a once in a lifetime thing, and I think that. It's almost like people that lived through the Great Depression that, you know,
yeah.
they had a certain mindset. And I feel like everyone is, is maybe a little bit traumatized just having lived through that horrible time. So yeah. If someone wants to reach out to you, if they're looking to grow their portfolio, whether they want to buy their first property or they want to add to your portfolio, well, what's the best way for someone to contact you?
Yes, wonderful. So there's a few ways. Our website, obviously, is very convenient, www.ridgelendinggroup.com. They can call us directly, toll-free at 855-747-4343. The easy way to remember that is 855-74-RIDGE. Or they can shoot us an email, info@ridgelendinggroup.com. Any one of those ways, and I'm on all the distributions, so I'm a little bit of a control freak that way. So I would actually see them come in and introduce myself and say hello and do a little discovery and fact-finding and be available to assist them with whatever their needs might be.
If you want to look that up later on, I've got a link to Chaley's website on my website. You can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode206. And if you are looking to buy a rental property, I 100% recommend that you reach out to Chaley. You can connect with her again at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode206. Do you want to save some money? Well, I want to let you know about a way that you can save some money the next time you need to rent a car. It's called autoslash.com. The way AutoSlash works is it will find you the best rate out there on a car rental. It will search the internet. It finds every single promo code. It will check if you're a member of Costco or AAA, USAA, whatever kind of discounts you might be eligible for. It will check those and find you the best rate out there on a car rental. Now, the real magic to AutoSlash is it doesn't stop working right there. It continues to search the internet, and if it finds a sale or it finds out that prices have dropped, it will notify you. You can go onto your tracker. You can cancel the first reservation with no penalty and rebook at the lower rate. The average user will get a couple of notifications and save 30% off the best available rate on other car rental sites. It's really cool. The best part about it is it's totally free. You can check it out at autoslash.com. That's AutoSlash. That's autoslash.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with a new episode next Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.